Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. Joining me now is I don't want to say an old friend of mine, but certainly a friend from quite a few years back, Tammy Bruce, who has a brand new book coming out that I am sorry, but maybe just the most timely book that you possibly can have. Tell us about your book here. And I would say the title, but it's off my screen.
Here we go. And I know what I'm doing. I've got my book right here. Fear Itself, Exposing the Left's Mind-Killing Agenda, which actually comes from, the phrase mind-killing comes from Herbert's Dune, which of course the youngsters watching this know from the films, but our generation read those books. And it was really, of course, a great deal about withstanding the issuance of fear and control of society by a massive government, and you know, really embracing our own selves when it comes to the nature of individualism and power. And you know, it was 3 years. Normally, it wouldn't have taken that long, but in the midst of COVID, I got COVID. I injured my shoulder. There was a whole bunch of other things going on. It's such a disruptive time from 2020 to 23, obviously, as we all know. But it started before the pandemic. And I was moved through a couple of personal experiences, but just in general, noticing, as we all were, even certainly after Trump's election, the behavior of the government, the constant fear-mongering, the constant lies, and the theme of that something wasn't right was really, you know, on our shoulders. And I started to think about, really, because we get so busy and the timelines of things move so quickly, we know something's not right. We see what's occurring. But I think it occurred to me it was important to be able to explain what the problem was, and that the fear we were feeling, the mass anxiety that is the result, is artificial. It is an ancient technique. It is deliberate, whether it be the riots of Black Lives Matter or the economy or COVID and what happened there, the ultimate example of this. And certainly the nature of what was being said and currently is what we're dealing with, the nature of how Donald Trump is portrayed, the argument that all of us are bad through global warming, our existence is bad through racism, it's systemic, it can never end. All of us then get moved into the category, the left does this, because we are more easily controllable. If you feel there's no hope, you have no control, then government must come in to save us. That is the one way the left can gain control. With fear, again, comes mass anxiety, comes a retreat from a willingness to participate politically and socially. And of course, that's reinforced with now what seems to be an emerging social credit system, where you can lose your job if you misgender someone, where the rules of speech keep changing, pronouns, all of these things, starting with political correctness in the 70s, through this dynamic where we are. And of course, now current events have moved our timeline really kind of together as we discuss the impact of fear-mongering and envy being used to control all of us.
You know, Tammy, this book is coming out, I believe, a week from today, right?
That's right. That's right. July 23rd.
This is a little unusual because normally we don't do author interviews. Because they're not usually available to talk about their books before the books actually come out, right? Unless you're friends with the author, which, you know, in this case is kind of friends with the author. It's great. But normally you want to have you want to hit the PR thing right on the publication date, July 23rd in this case. But the reason why we're talking about this today is twofold. One is you sent me the PDF of the book, which is really nice. But the other is because of what happened this weekend, right? This past weekend, the hysteria around Donald Trump's candidacy for president has grown so intense that it's really producing extremely irrational responses. And I don't want to necessarily create a cause-effect argument for what happened in this assassination that happened on Saturday, because we don't know yet. this guy could just be a nut. It could be sort of the case of what happened in the Gabby Gifford shooting, where it was just a lunatic who decided to show up with a gun and shoot a bunch of people. It had nothing to do with politics. Nonetheless, I think you and I and a lot of other Americans were not surprised that something like this was going to happen, because the hysteria around Donald Trump is supposedly, you know, the end of democracy and a dictator and a fascist and the new Hitler had gotten so intense that we were all afraid of an irrational response. So it didn't really surprise, I mean, it's a shocking event, but I don't know that anybody was really surprised that somebody actually acted on those, on that rhetoric, if indeed that was what happened.
Exactly. But I would argue that there's, you know, there's this sentiment that, well, if this shooter wasn't political, or for some reason he's the one 20-year-old on earth who doesn't have any social media, and that there's nothing on his phone, and you know, it's possible. Lord knows it's possible. My argument, though, this is a book that's not saying don't be afraid. Fear is a legitimate thing that's supposed to be transitory. It's been made chronic. And in my argument, as we talk about the rhetoric that has been used now for almost a decade, Ed, against not just Trump, but with Hillary Clinton in 2015 and 16, turning it, which was the unusual event, at the voters, that it was the basket full of deplorables, of irredeemables. It was a kind of demonizing of the American people that we had not seen. We see it with candidate to candidate, but that was a sign of a turn, that the people were the problem. Now, that's also not surprising, because they say it with global warming. Our very existence is destroying the planet. The new problem is our breathing, literally existing, is destroying the planet. So there's been this trend toward condemning, almost like, as I described briefly in the book, like a battered relationship, where you have the battering spouse attacking the wife. In this case, a man attacking his wife. The messaging in a domestic violence situation is about demeaning the target, telling her she is the problem, that all of this is happening only because of her behavior. If she would only be better, things would be better. She deserves to be punished. This is coming for you because you're bad. You're a bad person. And that's, we see this, I see this writ large in the nature of the government's treatment of the people. So we have Hillary Clinton starting it. And then this, the notion of systemic racism, in other words, for people of color and others, that you, there's nothing you can do, right? You've got white supremacists there. It's hopeless. We are saddled with this, and there's no solution except for the government to dictate how we behave and to punish people because they deserve punishment because they're bad. So when we get to Trump, of course, the nature, we see the dynamic expanding, because the left understands the Trump election was a sign that the training of the past had not worked, that we had misbehaved, that we were not voting for the next in line. We were not doing the right thing. So clearly there had to be more fear. There had to be more condemnation. And that's where it began to turn to be about Americans who were not conforming. And I think that, you know, what the left has done worldwide is, nobody wants slavery. We fought a civil war over that. Every living thing wants freedom. And yet the left offers this Dante's Inferno of life that can never be escaped, and that you're just going to have to deal with it. You're awful. We will take care of you. And, you know, people reject that. We reject those cages and that condemnation. And so Americans, you know, the good news is that when we saw an offer of something different, that it could be better, this wasn't Obama's new normal of just you have to deal with, you know, delivering pizzas for the rest of your life in order to pay your rent.
Learn to code.
Yeah. Learn to code. The coal miners, it's like, we're going to put a lot of those coal miners out of work. Ha, ha, ha. I mean, this kind of contempt was unacceptable. So with Trump's election, it wasn't just now there, it maybe it had failed. But then the messaging had to be even more serious, that they were going to destroy whoever would not pay allegiance to this new theme. And that's what we've seen them doing to Trump. It's very much almost pathological, because they're not thinking about the aftermath and whether or not it would work. And so this book, I mean, The Nature of Fear, it's all they've known. It's worked in the past. It worked in 2020. In the aftermath of COVID, it was the perfect experiment. So my book, I think what's important is we begin to feel that all of this is natural, the living in fear, chronic fear, mass anxiety, a retreat, who wants to be visited by the FBI, who wants to be on a list, the no-fly list, who wants to lose their job? None of us do. So they're relying on a retreat from public life and political life. But the moment, and I've had a couple of personal experiences, which I detail in the book, the moment I think there's a realization that this is artificial, it is a construct, it is not natural, and the left has to put all of its energy into it specifically for those reasons. Because the moment you look up, and that's what Trump compelled us to do, was to look up, we realize that none of that is true. And we can break that. It is a dynamic that is breakable. And I think part of it is I show the history of this ancient technique, how it's being applied now, the nature, and we can't imagine it because, who really wants people to live that way? Well, people on the left are projecting their misery on the rest of us. But it's about courage, right? We have been trained
right
to withhold our courage. And the simplest thing in the world, we all have to choose our battles, but we're doing that with Trump right now. We have to do it on other issues. And we have to end this kind of regime where we are every moment worried about what we say, what the new rules are, what the new language is, what the new punishment will be. And I think we're on the verge of breaking that ceiling. And I want my book to help us do that.
The book is Fear Itself. You can see it on the bookshelf behind Tammy. And when we put this up on the website, there'll be links and everything else. Because my little Joe Biden moment at the beginning of this podcast does not mean that this book is absolutely unforgettable. It absolutely is. But I want to tie this back to what happened on Saturday, because I was actually writing about this without actually having seen your book yet. I was actually writing about this on Saturday night. And again on Sunday morning.
Of course.
And I was saying that the remarkable part of what happened in Butler County, first off, that Donald Trump actually survived that assassination attempt. That was, you can argue with me all you want. That's providential
not
because God loves Donald Trump more than the firefighter who lost his life protecting his family, but because of what would have happened in this country had Donald Trump actually been killed on Saturday night. This country would look a lot different at the moment. But also, what happened after he got shot? He went down, which is smart. The Secret Service piled on top of him, which is what they're supposed to do. There's lots of room to talk about what the Secret Service didn't do. We're going to be talking about that for a long time. But they got on top of him. They did what was right. They got him back up and were surrounding him. And look, when you're shot, and he was shot through the ear, your body reacts to that. Just the fact that you got tackled by the Secret Service, your body's going to react to that. Your adrenaline shoots through the roof. You start shaking, and you have what's called the fight or flight reaction. That's a physical reaction. Most people would have stayed down and got off the stage without standing back up again. And the Secret Service were probably prepared for him to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And there wouldn't have been anything wrong with that, right?
Sure.
Totally understandable, even smart. Donald Trump stands back up, shakes his fist at whoever it was that was shooting. I don't think he understood that they had already killed the guy at that point. I don't know that his bodyguards understood that either. And said, fight, fight, fight. You get that iconic photograph from Evan Vucci from the New York Times, and a couple other people had very similar photographs. And to me, this was the real lesson here. He had every reason to fear, you know, and this is to me like an FDR moment. But then you take the title of your book, Fear Itself, is, I assume you're channeling FDR.
That's right.
Fear is fear itself. That's kind of what Donald Trump personified in that moment. And it's not that there isn't things to fear. You're right. There are very rational things to fear.
Sure.
But how you react to that fear is a choice.
Exactly.
And he stood up and he wasn't grabbing somebody's gun and firing back, you know, not stupidly retaliating. Mm-hmm. He stood up and said, I am not going to stay down. I'm going to stand up and let people know that I'm alive and I'm going to keep fighting. And that's the choice that's before us. And I think that's the choice. And you just were talking about that. That's the choice that this book is telling us that we have to make.
Exactly.
You don't think that fear is a weakness. Fear is a rational reaction. It's
a
impulse.
Yes. But I note Gavin DeBecker, who's the famous security expert right after the O.J. Simpson killings, had a book called The Gift of Fear. And it is a gift, but it's meant to be transitory. It's not meant to be chronic. It's been weaponized. And it's a message about choices you have to make using logic and reason. If you get stuck into the emotional reaction to fear, you're lost. But it can be reversed. I would add, Ed, about his response is based on the audience. He told it was both, I think, Selena Zito and Byron York in some interviews that when he got up and he sort of realized what was happening, obviously he understood he was shot, right? There's blood on his face. He knows something very bad has happened. And in that moment, as you perfectly described, you're in shock, right? You don't understand what, and you can see his face drained. But he said that when he looked out, no one had left in the field. And I get chills when I think about this. We saw that nobody in the bleachers had fled. There was no panicked escape or the 40,000 people running, despite maybe a dozen shots having rung out, knowing the president had been shot. He said he looked and saw that everyone waited, which is the remarkable, extraordinary message of this. And when he saw this was totally teamwork. He said he had to let them know that he was okay, which frankly you couldn't really know at that time, but he wanted to let them know. And I took his fist raise and the fight as a man who understandably, even instinctually, it could have been the last things that he had said publicly. He could be dead in an hour. He'd been shot, frankly, in the head by a centimeter. It missed the larger cranium area. So that was his message, was about not giving up, that you must continue in the nature of what we're trying to do here. That was it. As you're right, it wasn't him yelling, get me out of here. It was get my shoes, because they had tackled him so hard that they pulled him out of his shoes. It was, give me my shoes. He was still in charge. Give me my shoes. He knew he had to walk down the stairs. He did not want to be carried. Even from that moment, because no one else had fled, he knew that they needed to understand that he was going to be fine. He mentioned, I think it was to Byron York, that he wanted to keep speaking.
Yes. And
of course, that's quintessentially Trump. But he understood because he had just been shot. I mean, it's just so for the crowd, and this is the difference between, again, weaponizing fear for the left and people in that crowd being probably terrified. The difference in after the horrible murder of George Floyd, the training of people to be going out, riots, arson, murder in major American cities. And in this instance, not only did the crowd not panic and run, there was no violence, no riots, no arson. Even as we know that the Donald Trump, the GOP nominee for president, the former president, that they meant to blow his brains out on national, international television in front of 50,000 people, there was there has been a steadiness in large part because of leadership, that the right has not been told, you know, rioting and violence is normal. I'm sorry about this.
It happens when we're using, right. Don't worry about it. We're very relaxed here. So don't, no worries.
Right. I don't know how to get rid of it, but I think that's part of what some people are writing about is that that is one of the distinctive differences between how you can choose, as you've noted, to respond to fear and how other people and how the left has been trained to do the opposite. And I think that's invaluable in this regard.
You know, it's interesting too. And I don't think you mentioned it in the book, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. Malcolm X had a very famous speech where he talks about the use of fear, right? Now, it's about as close as I come to Malcolm X, you know, politically speaking. And when the Denzel Washington Spike Lee film, Malcolm X, or X, I think is what it's called. They do this. It's, you know, the speech where he says, you know, you've been run amok. I could not give you the whole speech. Denzel Washington would do it much better than me anyway. But 60 years ago, he was talking about the same thing. Now, again, I don't necessarily agree with, you know, where he was going with that. But he was warning people about the use of what you would call the fear industrial complex, I guess, in this book, right? Which is to instill fear into a population so that you can make them malleable and force them to be compliant, if not downright submissive.
That's correct, and
that's what you're getting at with this book, The Fear Industrial Complex. I'm just reading from the table of contents, obviously, but indoctrination centers, destroying individualism, manipulating reality, and we see that constantly in the media, which I think is very clearly part of the fear industrial complex, especially the last few years. And I think we see this in the censorship regime. I'm not sure how far you're going to get into this in the book, but you know, the whole censorship regime that came up because of the pandemic, you know, people weren't allowed to question constantly changing guidelines on how to react, you know, what you're supposed to do. Masking doesn't work. Suddenly masking is the bomb, you know, various different things, the 6-foot rule. And if you question that, you got your social media accounts suspended or canceled. That to me is part of what we're talking about, is to keep.
Absolutely. Part of it, it's these many different layers, right? It's one thing, it's the rhetoric that demonizes people, but it's about censorship that also sends a signal that other people can't be trusted and you can't be trusted. It's the economy, where you're never sure what the next day will bring, if you can pay your rent, if you can get gas into your car. That elicits a degree of fear, to say the least. The nature of crime, you don't know when it's safe, if your child can walk to school, what will happen to your mom when she's jogging in a park, because we've let millions of unvetted individuals into this country who clearly are, now we're finding, you know, hundreds of ISIS-associated individuals, MS-13, other, why wouldn't they come to the nation that has defunded the police? So the level of dynamic ramps up with the layers of not just being told you're irredeemable and an insidious white supremacist, even if you're not white, if there's whiteness and that's a problem, but that the world is ending because we're breathing, and that crime is now overtaking us, that there's literally, when you call stories that I talk about in the book, where you've got people calling 911 in certain cities and you wait for 10 minutes for the phone to be answered, where the police simply do not come because there are no police, there's every single element. And now, of course, we're, you know, legalizing marijuana. So effectively, they want you high and they want you drugged. They want you poor and they want you afraid. And but all of that is so unnatural that it has to be reinforced all the time. So even now, by the way, they're saying that if the shooter with the assassination attempt in Pennsylvania was not political, they don't find any political aspect of him. It proves my point that the rhetoric affects everyone, yeah, no matter their politics. And especially if you are, you know, not anchored somewhere and you're just disturbed, like the young man that was going to go and kill Justice Kavanaugh, that he was going to go get him, and even his rational mind intervened. He called his sister and said, "I don't want to do this." She convinced him to call 911, and he said, "I'm here, and I'm here to do something bad." He turned himself in. We can't forget that, because at the very end, no one wants to do this. Those are the lives that are ruined. So forget this argument that, oh, this, the Democrats and this rhetoric we've been dealing with, if this guy wasn't Antifa, then it means it's not Biden. It's not the rhetoric. It's not Hillary. It's even more part of that problem, because there's no natural reason for this guy to go into that environment and to shoot that man. So I think that that's a part of what we hear. Obviously, there's been no stopping or toning down of the rhetoric. There was a pause, maybe for 12 hours. And, Morning Joe had to be, canceled for one day, because I'm sure they felt they couldn't control themselves. The management did. They came back and were complaining. They did it after the baseball shooting, the baseball diamond shooting of the congressional members. Steve Scalise, thank God, survived. They did it after Kavanaugh, but people just shrugged in that regard. Remember, there was no extra security provided for him or the Supreme Court. It's an astounding set of developments that relies on people being too afraid to wear the MAGA hat, too afraid to openly say to their friends, "Yeah, this is what I'm doing. This is who I support." I don't know, Ed, maybe you agree with me that this shocking event has broken the spell. And I hope that maybe people are now willing to be honest. It seems on social media like they are more and more.
I think you're right. I think that the spell has been broken. I'm not sure for how long. Now, you talk about breaking the spell in the conclusion, and I don't want to give too much away, because I won't buy the book when it comes out. And once the book comes out and you've had a chance to make the rounds, I want you to come back. We'll talk more about it too.
Great.
Great conversation. And I want to keep going with it. But for right now, just give us a brief thumbnail of what your approach is in breaking the spell. And then let's talk about how the book's coming out, where you're going to be.
Great. Thank you. Right. The book has to explain things very often. Books just kind of show us and remind us, and it's important to do that, about what the left is doing, what the Marxist left has in mind. Knowledge is power, without sounding too trite here, but it's true. So the history is in the book, how it's being applied, and that's valuable. It's like turning the light on in the room to know that, wait a minute, this is a trick. This is a freaking trick. And the breaking the spell is personal. Right. It's great. You go to the school board meetings, right? You get more politically involved. We know those things, and that's all very important. But what the left has done is very personal to us. All of us have reacted personally to the dangers now that the current political world presents. And my solutions are personal. There's five PACs. And the first one, just to give you an idea, is making a decision. Decisions are powerful, real decisions. Not thinking about something, but deciding to do something is 85% of making the effort happen. The first pact is to decide to not let strangers determine how you feel about yourself or to determine who you are. So you hear these things about that you're racist, you're this and you're that. People are nice. Americans are sensitive. We don't want to be racist. We don't. And why would people lie to me that I'm a bad person? They are. They're lying to you about who you are. So there's four of these types of pacts of decisions we make about ourselves, actions we can take regarding courage. Again, we all have to pick our battles. I don't want anybody to lose their jobs. But the major step is the psychological shift that, wait a minute, and we heard this with some of the speakers at the convention the other night, that I am not going to let strangers, especially strangers who hate me, determine how I feel about myself and what my values are and who I am. I decide that. And yes, you have to be prepared for people to get mad. Well, they want you to be afraid of that. They want you to be afraid of being called a name, afraid of them getting mad, afraid of what it means. You decide that. So it's a reminder about the personal power we have and how all of this, you know, we're having a larger philosophical conversation about national and international events and repercussions, but it comes down, and I describe in some of my personal experiences, the personal realizations and choices that we make about who we are. And that is part of certainly breaking the spell by waking up to the reality of our situation.
Well, there you go. And that's what you can find in Fear Itself, the new book from Tammy Bruce. Comes out next week on July 23rd.
That's right.
And I'm assuming you've got a website set up for this, Tammy? And
yes, yes. People can go to tammybruce.com. And also, it's obviously on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You can pre-order it now. It'll arrive on the day that it's released. There is an audiobook version, the Kindle version. But pre-ordering now is important in a way because it tells the brick and mortars and even the mass sellers that the book is going to do well. And we won't have the, oh, it's out of stock problem for 2 weeks when people want it. So pre-ordering now would be terrific.
Pre-order. I can tell you as a published author, pre-orders are very important. And
right.
Definitely pre-order. I'm assuming you've got the book promotion tour ready to roll out on
Tuesday. Well, you know, this is my first book in 17 years because it was an ordeal. I don't really like writing. This though was so important. I was compelled to do it. But my last book, there was no social media. There was none of this kind of dynamic with podcasts. It's like, I feel like Pete Bog Man emerging into the modern world. So we're doing, you know, I'm doing a lot of interviews with, of course, my home at Fox News, radio, interviews with you. Some things are in the works when it comes to going to certain cities and certain events. But right now it's about getting the word out because it's a different kind of book and it's about a larger issue. And I love these longer conversations. It's terrific.
Yeah, me too. And I'm so glad that you were able to take some time out now to do this after the events of this past weekend. And definitely we need to be talking about fear and being run amok. I'll quote Malcolm X at least one more time, I guess. I don't know, but
please.
And that's what you're talking about too. Fear Itself, Tammy Bruce. Pre-order it now, please. Tammy, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
And we're definitely going to do this again soon.
Thank you, dear.